Welcome back to the show, you all. We got I'm your host, Sully, and our man of the hour is writer, producer, and actor Steve Harper. You might know him from some of your favorite procedurals, but the man is busy just crafting just so many dramas and thrillers for the small screen as well as for your favorite streaming platforms. He was part of the Emmy-winning web series Send Me, as well as Tell Me a Secret, American Crime, and currently Stargirl. And most recently, Godfriended Me.
Yes. Yeah. So Godfriended Me before Stargirl. Stargirl was the most recent. But yes. And we were nominated. Send Me was nominated for the Emmy, but we didn't win the Emmy. So just to be clear, I'd love to claim it, but we didn't actually take the statue home. So.
It's a great YouTube series.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm really happy to be here and looking forward to chatting with you and yeah, it's like you guys have been doing rocking it with all your episodes.
Too much.
And it's amazing. Like quite a record of positive reviews as well. And, you know, it's a great show. So that makes complete sense. But part of the reason I bring this up is that I just started a podcast. And I know how eager we are for, in general, for like audience response and reaction. So it seems that you guys have cornered the market on that, which is great.
It's not easy. It really isn't.
What's the secret? Is there one?
I don't think anyone knows the secret, really. It's kind of like asking where the key is to unlocking a certain house that everyone wants, but no one wants to buy yet. It's almost like a monkey's paw in a way, where it's like, if I unleash it, will I be sorry for the consequences? But truth be told, it's like, you're right. Anyone can do it. It's just, do you want to do it?
Right.
And you want to get better at it? Or do you just want to BS with your friends and just kind of say, well, we had fun. Not sure we got anything in the can.
Yeah. And I think the same can be said, is true of writing or acting or, you know, there's a certain amount of dedication, commitment that needs to happen and persistence and then marketing and then networking. You know, there's all of that stuff that it's essential in order to keep it all going.
Absolutely. So you had the fortune of having two New York City educators who happen to be your folks.
Yes.
Raised there in the Big Apple. What did you think you took away from them the most before getting into all these creative endeavors?
Well, I think one of the things that's been really, that has always been really helpful for me is, you know, my mother was they're both retired, was a guidance counselor at a high school in Brooklyn. Sweet. My father was an art teacher at a middle school in Queens. And so there was always this sense of art. Like art was never, you know, I talk to a lot of people, I'm sure you do too, for whom art for their parents was like a third rail. Like, don't do that. Like, do anything.
Why would you do this?
Exactly. But my parents were never like that. Like, they were very excited for me to do, you know, to write poetry, to write short stories, to, you know, I used to draw my own comic books or whatever. So the first thing I have to say is that they were really great in promoting and supporting and celebrating the arts. And they were super happy for anything artistic that I did sort of in, you know, in the acting space, in the writing space, any of that. They did want me to get a degree that, you know, had some sort of realistic value. Although, you know, they allowed me to, I was an English and theater studies major. So English was sort of my, you know, my safety subject, which doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. But, you know, but that's one of the things that I took away from them is a love for the arts, a love for education. And certainly I also feel like they were and are people who really believe in giving back, like, you know, helping people out and, you know, supporting other people, supporting the community. You know, teaching, I think, is a fundamentally, you know, kind of almost spiritual, like pass the wisdom on to the next generation kind of thing. And that's really who my parents are.
And so they really influence you a lot to just be kind of a understudy, the next kind of Samaritan in a way.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think it's, for me, it's one of the reasons why, in addition to all the work that I love to do that's creative for my own sort of artistic journey. You know, I love, you know, I also coach writers, you know, through my company, yourcreativelife.com. And I put out a newsletter and I have a YouTube channel. And, you know, this podcast that I mentioned, like, is me and another coach talking about what it's like to be writers and, you know, how we face the writing life day by day, month by month, year by year. And all of those things, I think, are really important in terms of passing on the wisdom.
Stellar. And you know, you have three different doctorates. You got numerous experiences, including ADR, which for those who don't know is additional dialogue recording. How many brains did you pick when getting into all these various?
Yeah. Well, I have to say, it's a great question because I do feel like I've picked a lot of brains. Like I just, one of the things about, you know, and I think it's true of, you know, as you said, you were talking about the whole podcasting thing and how there's not a secret, you know, there's not a secret, but on some level there is, like, you know, there are things that people know.
And so fruit, but is it really?
Yeah, right. So I've always been the kind of guy who just continues to ask questions, you know, to reach out to people who are doing the thing that I want to do and asking them, well, how did you get here? And what's your advice about this? And how, you know, so I think before I was acting professionally, I asked a lot of questions of actors, you know, before I was writing professionally, I asked a lot of questions about writers, from writers about the industry and how do you get in and how do you survive? And, you know, so I think every step of my career, I peppered somebody with questions before I knew what to do and where to go and how to behave and how to stay and how not to get kicked out of the room and how to get asked back and all that stuff. So lots and lots and lots and lots of questions.
Were there any professors who you just really, really influenced you also, just kind of your style of just gathering info and just making notes?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I was an English and theater studies major, as I said, and I was an undergrad at Yale, and, you know, and I had some really good, I remember this one guy who was a very intense director, but a fantastic acting teacher, no longer with us, a man named Nico Sakharopoulos, you know, and he Wow. he was a very sort of brilliant director, but very intense, you know, Greek guy who was, he would tell it like it is, you know, if he didn't think you were acting well, he'd be like, you know, he'd completely insult you. And, you know, he'd be like, I'd rather watch a car crash than watch you act, you know, which, you know, I don't necessarily believe in the brutality, but I do think that there's something about kind of the straightforwardness of that energy and the rigorousness of that process that I think I learned a lot through. You know, I also think, you know, when I was fortunate enough to do the playwriting program at Juilliard, and, you know, Chris Durang and Marsha Norman, who are both like world-class playwrights, and, you know, Marsha has also written books, scripts for a lot of musicals. Chris has written some musical stuff as well. I mean, they were really fantastic in their, you know, their work is so different. And they just had some like simple guidance and questions for all of us as we brought work into our playwriting class, you know, about, you know, what's this character up to and what's next? And, you know, Marsha would always say, get to the end, you know, really encouraging us to like finish the work, like keep going,
conclude,
to discover what's along the way. And so I think there were a lot of people like Chris and Marsha, like Nikos, you know, who I learned from. And whose messages I still think about today.
It's very intriguing reminiscing about that because, like you say, it's you're taking all these, I guess you could say, six different voices at this point now. You're still having to incorporate it. How do you think you filtered it out to where it's like, okay, but this is me versus this is them, and this is the part of them I want to be a part of me?
Yes, that's a really great question. I think, I don't know, I guess, you know, waking up and going to sleep with me every day, like I feel like I have a pretty good radar for you what those parts are. Right. I've always got me. So I have this pretty good, you know, sense of what my instincts are, certainly on the page now. I mean, I'm doing, you know, I started out years and years ago writing short stories and doing fiction stuff. And I'm beginning to return to that space. So I'm, you know, I'm actually every day now I'm like working on this fiction piece. Who knows what's going to happen to it? But it's all what I love about it that sort of feels almost like a spiritual discipline is it's all me. It's all my instincts, you know, blank page. And, you know, there's a character, there's a situation. What do I want to know about that character? What am I curious about? What's happening to him? How do I describe it? What are his reflections? What are my reflections about his reflections? Do I put those in the, you know, do I put those in the the narrative? Do I leave them out? Are there things that he says? Are there things that he doesn't say? Like, I'm just, you know, I'm kind of in this space where I'm, where all my instincts are like right there as I try to sort of see what the scene is, you know, and I ask myself, what do I want to know next, or what's happening next, or how do I describe that, you know? So I don't know. I feel like fundamentally I'm connected to my instincts, which, you know, which are really about, I think at the end of the day, they're really about humanity. They're really about like, I'm really interested in what does it mean to be a human being on the planet? Like, how do people feel, and how do people, what are people afraid of, and how do they fight back, and how do they live their best lives? And, you know, I'm really interested in those sort of human questions rather than, I know some writers are really interested in sort of the larger, like, you know, sort of the big set piece questions, like, you know, space or monsters or, you know, but I'm always interested, even if I'm playing in those worlds where there's magic and there's any of those other things, I really want to know, like, what's it like to be a human being standing next to a monster or creating a monster or running from a monster? Like, what's the human experience of this thing? That's what I'm obsessed with.
That's a perfect segue, because most of your work is all dealing with human nature and being grateful or ungrateful, and then understanding your past. Do you feel like a lot of it's come across pretty perfectly in your work? You know, because sometimes you don't get feedback right away.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have to say that one of the things that is challenging about being inside my own artist's life is that there is no perfect. Like, I can only throw darts against the wall. You know, I can only like try to do stuff. And sometimes, and I think it's, you know, it's almost a perfect, and I was talking about this actually the other week, it's almost like when one of the things I love to do is I do a lot of tweeting, you know, and a lot of live tweeting during episodes and stuff like that, which I'm sure you've seen, and maybe some of your listeners have also seen, because I'm very connected / addicted to Twitter. But one of the reasons I do that, particularly around a show that I'm on, is that, like you said, like, we don't get any feedback. So for us, like, we get on this train of, you know, we got on the Stargirl train, and we, you know, we wrote that season and did everything. Like, our writer's room ended almost a year ago, you know? And so we're in there doing things, tweaking things, changing things, saying things, having characters say things. And we know what we think about that. We know what the studio, you know, who are like putting up the money, and what the network airing the show, what they think, what those executives think. But we don't know how does it play in Texas? How does it play in Topeka? You know, how does it play in, you know, in Canada? Like, we have no idea. So there's something delightful, you know, also coming out of the theater, like, you know, connecting to the audience. There's something delightful about suddenly hearing people say, that's great, that's so amazing, or that really sucks, like, they really what a terrible episode, you know. And I think you gotta, you know, in this perfection idea, I gotta take the good with the bad. Like, there are people who are gonna love what I do, and there are people who are going to not love what I do, no matter what it is. Like, every play, every script, every short story, everything, like every blog post, there are some people who are going to be like, that's amazing. And there are other people who are like, yeah, I don't know what he's done. What is this?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah. So there's a certain amount of acceptance, I think, with that.
Yeah, hopefully with the post Elon Musk takeover, there's still a way to filter out some of the toxicity on there, because there was one person I knew on there who would basically troll the Law and Order SVU writers room page. It's like, what? Boy. Why do that? Why? Yeah. That doesn't give any feedback. I don't think they're going to take it. They're probably on there for 10 minutes and then off until the next episode airs. I don't see why you think they're listening on this.
I also think that there's, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I feel like there's a real issue that we have. Like, we just, you know, I think certainly before people step into the industry, when the, whatever, the creators just, you know, they don't seem like people. So it's very easy through the medium like Twitter or social media to be like, those writers should be killed, or what a dumb, that it should be blown up, or that, you know, I hate that, and from the other side, it's like, we're all human beings, like trying to do our best, trying to put out a product, trying to earn a living.
You don't know if they're serious or not, if they're just idiots,
you know. And you know, there are some of those out there, but I also think that there are a lot of people who just sort of forget. Like, it's really easy in our culture to just, you know, whatever, throw stones at whatever,
celebrities. They're not real people.
Yeah,
what's the difference between a writer?
Well, you got some real people, you know, on the other side of
it. But it's
thing,
amazing how somebody will just throw it out. They'll do it like they do with politicians. And it's like, okay, some of them are actual humanitarians. You can tell them apart from the businessmen in the nice suit.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And obviously, you know, this is a very diverse set of work that you've had. I didn't get into Tell Me Your Secrets until I think, again, you know, a year later, because Amazon didn't really promote it all that much. I just kept getting recommended.
Yes, we originally made Tell Me Your Secrets for TNT, and it was supposed to be on TNT, and then it wasn't on TNT, and then it was going to be on HBO Max, and then it wasn't on HBO Max, and they weren't sure what to do with it. And then Amazon picked it up, and people got to see it. And I have to say, you know, again, part of the human element of the challenge and the joy, the adventure of being in the industry the way I am is, you know, I was afraid. I think a lot of people were. It's a crazy show, as people who've seen it, as people who've seen Tell Me Your Secrets knows. But, you know, there's something really delightful, again, about having an audience see the work. So at least for us, you know, I could say I was on that show and people could say, oh, yeah, I remember that show. As opposed to, there are some writers in this industry who do a whole bunch of work on shows that never see the light of day. And then if you say, I was on Robot Wars, people like, I don't know. Yeah, you wouldn't know it because it never got on, you know. So I was really grateful that it got on, that people got to see it. And there are, you know, there are a handful of people who really love that show, who are really riveted by it, and reached out to me and, you know, were hoping for a second season. And that's all delightful, because otherwise you just don't know.
Totally. I have an aunt who was watching God Friend and Me because she just wanted some comfort food, something that was laid back, that didn't have any sex and violence. And
yes, right.
Obviously, many DC fans really do feel like Stargirl's underrated, and American Crime was a big award nom for quite a while that a lot of people watched. But again, you didn't really get that feedback, even in post Twitter. And I have a psychic pal who was obsessed with Covert Affairs. So.
Really? No kidding.
Yeah,
no,
but, I love that. But that's another one. Is like, it was kind of in that shuffle. Is like, if you weren't watching NCIS or 24, you were watching whatever's on USA Network. You know, that was one of the shows, along with Burn Notice. And again, you just didn't know unless you knew. So
I think that's why it's really important to, you know, I think anywhere I can find information, you know. There's a Stargirl Facebook page that I'm on. There's, you know, the whole live tweeting thing. And, you know, I'll also go and read people's reviews, or, you know, the podcasts that sort of spring up around particular shows. It's really instructive to me as a person who's on the show to find out how the choices we made land. And also, you know, the other thing that's super interesting is, you know, there are things that we wrestle about or argue about in the writer's room, like, oh, that's dumb, or I can't believe we're doing that, or whatever. And, you know, maybe this or that, and the showrunner's like, no, we're doing this, you know. And sometimes it's interesting to see, like, oh yeah, that really worked. I didn't think that was gonna work. I didn't think people would appreciate that. Or yeah, that didn't work so much, and people are not so happy with that moment. And I was in the writer's room saying, I don't know about that one, you know. So that's another interesting level to be on, you know.
Absolutely. And since you've been in front of the camera and you've done so many side projects and what have, what would you say that also just kind of all together just kind of makes it just flow more easier for you?
I think there's, for me, there's a, it's all connected, right? So I think one of the things that I am grateful for as a writer is, you know, that I know, I always have my actor brain on when I'm writing. So quite often in a writer's room, I'll be the guy who says, well, wait a minute, you know, she just had that fight with her mom. So how is that going to, you know, influence the way she enters this scene when she's talking to somebody else's mom? She might not have respect for it. Yeah. So I'm always about that, the motivation, the perspective, the emotional backlash. And so I think all of the things that I've done in the industry that I'm really grateful to have done, I do think they feed each other. You know, there is like, you can't not know, you can't forget, you can't unknow what you know.
Yeah.
A friend of mine used to say, so I can't unknow what it's like to be an actor. I can't unknow what it's like to have directed. I can't unknow what it's like to produce. And, you know, and you find that, I think this is really interesting. Like, you know, I find that the more I do this, the more I understand what the constraints are. You know, I remember when I first came into the world of TV and I didn't realize how, you know, if you write a scene that takes place, for example, we had a thing on Covert Affairs on one of the episodes I wrote where we had a chase that took place in a parking garage.
Yes.
And they couldn't, when it came to time to find locations, they couldn't find a parking garage that suited our needs. And so we ended up setting it, we had to set it someplace else. And one of the things that we had seen was this auto mechanics shop, this auto shop. And it was a very small, like the other scene had this sort of, you know, scope to it. This was a very small space. So I had to rewrite the scene to take place in the auto body shop. And that was so interesting. And so it's very easy as a writer to just, you know, to just put in the stage directions.
Oh, the book. No, change it.
Yeah, right. To put in the stage directions, you know, it takes place at a mall. No, it takes place at a movie theater. No, it takes place at a park. Like, but every one of those things, when you come to production, you've really got to think of the scope, the expense, the availability. Like those are the kinds of things that I now think about as a writer, you know, that I wasn't thinking about when I first came into the industry. And I think that's, again, that's partly knowing production and understanding a little bit about how the sausage is made.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You might enjoy this. Your multi-character dramas, Dark September Rain and Broadway's Finest are on Tubi and Prime, to be fair.
Oh, cool. So oh, that's good. I didn't realize that.
It's very intriguing how a lot of these movies are just getting a second chance. It's like, oh, that one movie, oh, I always saw it at the video store, never picked it up. You know,
it's, yes, all this stuff. Now it's here. Yes.
There, right. got no reason to not seek it out.
Yes. Well, we're in such an interesting time. There's so much content. Everybody's talking about that. And to try to decide like where to put your focus, like what am I going to watch, you know, and how,
yeah,
there's so many things to watch. It's really, it's a lot. But what that means is that I think audiences hopefully on some level are becoming a little bit sharper in terms of what they want to see. And B, you know, hopefully it'll continue that there are more opportunities for writers out there because people are really hungry for content, for storytelling, for character development, all that stuff. So hopefully
they're actually using their words now.
Yeah, right.
We got a phone that doesn't give you the right to be dumb and leave an unhelpful response.
Yeah.
So-and-so's face is fat. Well, that's hurtful and that doesn't help anybody. So what were you trying to do with this? Oh, nothing. Right. Okay. Well, someone can actually give you a five, you know, giant detailed thing. Hey, this was very well thought out, but I was lost at the ending. I'm not sure if that's a cliffhanger or not. Okay, that tells me.
Right, that tells me something. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Just yesterday, I was having this conversation with some friends about, you know, all the AI stuff that's emerging.
Oh, it's creepy, right?
It is a little creepy because, you know, now we're talking about, or people are saying like that these AI programs can, you know, can write scripts and stuff like that. And so, you know, right now those scripts are not fantastic. But, you know, the notion of moving toward an age when we're sort of eliminating the human being and we're just having scripts that are created by an AI, it's like, I hope we don't get there. I'm not particularly interested in that. You know, eliminate a lot of jobs if that's the case. And I don't know if we really want to do that.
I don't think Hollywood's ready to be on a Walmart budget where they just have the computer respond to phone calls.
Yes.
But like you say, with that whole Skynet notion, it is kind of like, I would always for years hear about makeup artists were dreading that. They're like, well, if someone has to fix that, word's going to get around. I'm not a good makeup artist. Stuntmen have been angry because there's like, well, so basically all the stuff we did, it can't be displayed on screen because it's been digitally glossed over. We're replaced with a giant creature that we're playing in a green screen suit.
And it's tricky because I'm very pro technology. I love my technology. Yeah. I spent 10 years as a computer trainer when I lived in New York, and, you know, which was basically like, in my view, sort of like a driving instructor for computer users, as opposed to a car mechanic. Like, I didn't repair computers, but I would teach people how to use Excel and Word and the mouse and, you know, a number of specialty programs. So I love technology. And, you know, and I also think technology has its limits in terms of when it comes to art, comes to those sorts of things.
There's pros and cons. Do you think you would, what along with material like that, as long with, you know, you've already conquered a lot of social topics in a lot of your work. What are some other material that you'd like to kind of explore without, you know, giving away any ideas necessarily?
Well, you know, I haven't yet done anything that sort of, you know, I'm very interested in magical realism. And so there's a certain amount of sort of sci-fi stuff. You know, my web series Send Me, that was Emmy nominated for Tracy Tom's amazing performance, which people can find it on YouTube if they want to, you know, if you
Please look up Send Me web series,
go check it out on YouTube. 40 minutes to watch the whole first season. But, you know, I love grounded sci-fi. I have never done anything that takes place like in space or with space. Mm-hmm. So it just occurs to me, it's such a great question that you asked, because I hadn't really thought about it, but that would be cool to sort of dabble in the, you know, space exploration kind of world. I've never actually done that. And that, I think that would be really fun.
Absolutely. Because it seems like, even though there were plenty of other shows, which were basically like outer space, hospitals and police stations and other stuff, it can kind of contradict themselves. It's like, one minute, you know, they're kind of doing what the network suggests, which is be formulaic, and other times they're like, well, be edgy or be outside the normal scope. And then again, when you got those two warring conflicts, it's like, it's even more confusing, because you you know, obviously you got to move on past the feedback, but then it's like, so what does everyone like or not like about the program?
And I think that's tough, because, you know, it's like, are we, and maybe I think it's certainly from a corporate perspective, we do this, but is it all going to be about surveys? Is it all going to be about like what's most popular? Or, you know, because I feel like some of the time we get into the spaces of the unique shows that end up being, you know, really popular, because a writer just looked in within his or her or their heart and said, what am I interested in? What do I want to explore that nobody's talking about, that nobody's writing about, that hasn't been done yet, you know? And I think there's something really useful about that. So, I mean, my hope is that for me and other creatives is that we end up sort of following our own hearts rather than always looking toward the mandate of this studio or that network, or, you know, I think that's where we really get creative and out of the box ideas.
Totally. Because you're just so fortunate to be on just so many different kinds of productions. Like Stargirl is kind of doing its own thing instead of trying to worry about doing a crossover with one of the other DC shows, and American Crime, that kind of came out when ABC was, you know, they've got other shows like that right now, like Alaska Daily, but they were kind of looking for what can be our serious show, kind of like The Practice. But
let
you talk about something, you know, ethics, morals, and day-to-day life that's something that's not 30 something, but kind of like that, you know.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, I think there is something about these pieces that are out of the box. You know, American Crime was out of the box for its time, and you know, God Friended Me, it was like, you know, CBS had things like Touched by an Angel, and
exactly,
there were always Joan of Arcadia, you know, but certainly this sort of confluence of, you know, technology and, you know, and on some level race and, you know, and spirituality, like those things had not been put together in a TV series in the way that they were in God Friended Me. And I think people who dug the show really appreciated that.
1000%. Cause yeah, it was like, hey audience, if you like this, check our show out. But at the same time, we're way different. You'll like it if you're looking for something different, but please check us out.
Right. Yeah.
Compare us after you've actually seen it versus what the marketing is doing.
Yes, that's right. Yes, which goes back to this whole thing of like, how many things can we see? And I mean, hopefully people get to sample, you know, or are drawn. People are always drawn, I think, to things that they feel like they can relate to. So hopefully on some level, there's not everything for everybody out there. And at the same time,
yeah,
you know, I do think it's important to kind of gravitate toward like, oh, this is the kind of show that I like, and here's something like it, or this is the kind of show that I like, and so I'm going to try to create that, or, you know, to lean into what we appreciate as audience and as writer.
1000%. Do you have a few other scripts that you maybe sold and you kind of want to rework and sell again, perhaps?
You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. I've got a piece that I've been trying to sell this year that I won't talk too much about, but I've also got my web series Send Me. I wrote a TV version of it, and actually John Ridley and I, after my year at an American Crime, went about trying to sell that show as a full-fledged TV version. And the script is very different in a number of different ways. And, you know, we got a lot of traction. It was interesting. Like, there were a lot of people who really appreciated it. And yet, for whatever reason, we couldn't, nobody was buying at the time. It'll be interesting for me to see, you know, now that I didn't really know about, my show is about time travel and slavery and, you know, and sort of has some of the same DNA as Kindred, Octavia Butler's science fiction classic, which has now been turned into a series on FX on Hulu, which I'm looking forward to seeing. It just premiered. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how people respond to that that piece, because some of the DNA is similar to what we were doing. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really fantastic about that piece is that people are able to recognize it as something that's been around for a while. And so therefore it's got a, you know, this intellectual property, this IP, this cred that our show didn't have because it wasn't based on a book, you know. So I feel like that's one of the things that really helps. And I'll be curious to see how they treat that material, and B, how audiences respond to it. It'll be really interesting.
Oh, 1000%. And it seems like all the genres are kind of messing around with a few different formulas. Today's action movies want to kind of get a John Wick or Equalizer formula, show a dark crime underworld. And
yes,
to your point, it seems like now if you want more social commentary, you want to do it in a horror movie or show. Them and Lovecraft Country, it was pretty wild how they were both coming out with a 50s, you know, Jim Crow type aspect. What would terrifying tales like this be like? Have something for the Tales for the Crypt crowd, and then have something for the very, you know, emotional, you know, resonating crowd who want to see how we've come so far and there's still a lot of backwards people who we have to deal with.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's really interesting to see those trends, and I'm curious to see whether and how they continue in television, because, you know, those shows which are both really interesting shows at this point, you know, that was a little while ago, you know, no second season for them, no second season for Lovecraft. It's sort of like,
unfortunately,
okay, so what happens now? Like, what happens with all those great juicy ideas and that kind of world? And, you know, will we get a chance to see more of that in the future? It'd be really interesting.
Absolutely. You have some of your shorts on your website. Have you thought of maybe repackaging them in maybe a anthology film?
It's such an interesting question. I love
because festivals are picky. They like to do the whole It used to be you could air it on TV, but still, and that was part of the marketing tool, as seen on HBO or Showtime. And it's going to be at cons in 10 days. And now everyone's like, I got to be the first one to show it. So that's why release dates are a little contrarian, because they can't let you know, hey, I submitted it to these 20 high-ranking festivals all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good question, and I haven't really thought of that. It's like, it's something that I'll have to percolate on. I mean,
chances.
I've more thought about, you know, what the new thing is. Like, you know, is there a new short film, or is there, you know, this year I came out with an anthology of short plays called A Few Short Plays to Save the World. And there are a bunch of short, like 10-minute plays, and some longer, some shorter, in that collection that I've often thought, oh, that could make an interesting short film.
That's why you made it a book.
Yeah. So I made it a book so that people can get a chance to encounter them. I also, you know, to go back to my acting days, one of the reasons why I created this anthology was I've always been hungry to, as an acting student, to find more diverse material. You know, like we were doing a lot of like Arthur Miller and, you know, Tennessee Williams. This was a while ago. And there are diverse, you know, there are Black playwrights and queer playwrights and Asian playwrights and, you know, Indian American playwrights and stuff. So there's a lot more material now. And I really want people to, you know, get this collection, read this collection, use this material for scene classes. For
adapt it, please.
I mean, that's partly why I'm so excited about having that out in the world. But, you know, I've more thought in terms of the short film space of, you know, the kind of new material, like what would it be like today, you know, when Send Me came out, Send Me came out in like 2016. And I'm sure the landscape of even film festivals and all that stuff has changed quite a bit. So
much.
I've been curious, you know, like what would it be like to take a piece out now and to be in the festival game now? It's something that I'm curious.
Yeah. About. It's like they're desperate for content, but yet they still kind of they're a little hard nosed about it. So it's just, you don't know if there's different programmers or if it's just, it's here to stay for a bit. Keep brainstorming.
Yeah. And I think like so many creative things, you just have to roll the dice and, you know, sort of see what happens, you know? So perhaps that's in my future.
Do you think there's been, unfortunately, still a commonplace trend of people pitch ideas and, you know, producers turn it down because they're like, I can do that my way cheaper without buying his idea, change it up enough to where I don't have to face a lawsuit?
I think that does happen a lot. And you know, for me, I'm happy to be in the Hollywood game. And, you know, I've certainly done a bunch of pitching. At the same time, you know, I'd rather be pitching original material than, you know, than sort of trying to mold it to mandates. But B, you know, I'd also rather be trying to make stuff without sort of asking permission to make stuff. I mean, it's such an expensive business, but I feel like all the creatives that I know and a lot of the folks that I coach and the people that I, you know, I'm regularly talking to, I'm really urging them to continue to make stuff, like whatever it looks like, whether it's like you're writing the narrative of a short story, or you're creating your own graphic novel, or you're creating like one panel comic books, or you're creating YouTube videos and doing stand up, or like, I just feel like there's such an opportunity for us to create stuff, to make things rather than just keep asking for permission. So sometimes we have to, you know, it's like, obviously we all have to pay the bills. And we can't all foot the cost, you know, and, you know, some of us can crowdfund, and that's certainly a skill. But I feel like to me, the paramount thing is how do I make stuff, and how do I make more stuff, you know? And sometimes that'll involve me asking people for permission, but hopefully more and more it won't. It'll be like, I'm going to fund this, or I'm going to crowdfund that, or things like that.
Yikes. It seems like also that, to your point, it does seem like there are pretty people who kind of want you to ask permission. It's like, well, you don't own this idea.
Until I
sign the papers and give you permission to make the best or ruin my idea.
Right. Yes. I mean, it's also one of the reasons why, you know, for those of us who are out there pitching, and for anybody who's listening, who's out there pitching or working on a pitch, you know, one of the most important things you can possibly do in any pitch is, you know, I always start with a story about myself, you know, because the thing that I want to do is sort of link my DNA as a writer to the telling of this story, so that when whoever buys it, they say, well, he's got to be the one to write it because we recognize how his DNA informed what this story is. If you just say, like, here's a really cool story about like robots, dinosaurs, and the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, chances are that whoever you're pitching to will say, oh, what a great story. You know, Spike Lee's right next door. I'm going to get him to make this, you know, or so-and-so's down the block and JJ Abrams is down the block. I'm just going to talk to him about it. Right. Unless you link your DNA to the idea, like they're, you know, you're going to be disposable, and no writer wants that.
No. Oh man. And for those who are obviously, you know, trying to pitch ideas around, do you think, who do you think is more privy to it? Friends of friends, or is it more just like certain circles specifically?
Well, in terms of privy to
like a creative pitch or just any other kind of creative meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of going out there and pitching stuff, I feel like you just have to practice. And sometimes, you know, you start out practicing with people, you know, with friends and then friends of friends, you know, and then it's kind of like everything else, as you get to know people in the industry, you know, hopefully you get to know them well enough that after a while you ask them, like, do you know any places where I might, you know, is there an executive, you know, is there a, you know, where might I take this, or, you know, and the more we can connect ourselves to other people and lean into those relationships, the more we can have avenues where, you know, somebody might say, oh my God, I know this guy. He's a terrific executive over at Sony and he's looking for exactly this kind of thing. And, you know, and then to know that you just have to throw stuff against the wall. Like you might go and pitch and they might not buy it, you know, like even if you come in hot, even if they're like, oh, we've heard this and we love what we think we love what you're doing, you know, there are no,
I like it, but not today.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Happens all the time. But that's also part of it. You know, it's like, if you want to be in the industry, then you got to be willing to roll the dice in that way. And that's, that I think is part of the bravery of, you know, showing up as this kind of artist.
1000%. So I saw that you liked, your household was filled apparently with a lot of true crime books. Have you thought of maybe doing and obviously American Crime dealt with a lot of headline based material. Yes. Have you thought of possibly doing maybe a podcast documentary series or any audio dramas? You know,
I haven't really thought that much about, I'm not particularly, you know, my mother is obsessed with true crime, serial killers, and
or just any drama, just stuff. Fiction.
But you know, there is an idea that I'm beginning to percolate around that does have you know, a crime basis for like the first time, I think, ever. And so I'm curious about that. I'm curious about like my version of that, which I think is you know, has a procedural element to it, but is more again about the humanity of the person looking into this than about, you know, cool, gruesome murders.
Yeah, know? No, I'm not.
So I think it's all about what the perspective might be, you know, and what the angle might be on that sort of thing.
Totally. I noticed Dramafy allows people to submit any kind of audio drama. It's just got to be a certain bit rate and only have one or two uses of damn or hell. It's like, okay. So I gotta keep it PG rated, which is a challenge.
Yes, right, yeah, that's interesting.
And I guess, how would you describe a lot of the writers' rooms that you were in? Was a lot of it just kind of just come back with an idea and try to sell, you know, the showrunner on the idea?
That's such a great question. I think all writers' rooms are different. So that's the first thing. You know, it's sort of like if you say, like, how's this grocery store compared to that grocery store? Well, these people have the produce over here and those people have the produce over there.
This is great value. Really, this is a Kroger.
Right, exactly. These people are really like the people who work there are really friendly. These people are a lot less friendly. They don't really like to help us, you know. Like not every writer's room service. has its different thing. But I do think the best rooms that I've been in are the rooms where people, where the showrunner, you know, the captain of the ship, whoever he or she is, like they know where they're going. They're like, this is the plan for the season. And then they ask the writers to help me fill in this plan. Help me fill in the details here. Help me, you know, tweak this relationship. Help me come up with a cliffhanger for episode 3, you know.
We know they're going across a bridge. What kind of bridge is it?
Exactly. And so those instances, the job is pretty clear. It's sort of like, okay, we're filling in the color on this, you know, on this black and white painting. And I think one of the masters of that in my experience was John Ridley. I mean, he was really clear the first day of our season on American Crime on season 3. I mean, we talked generally, but then I think it might have been the second day or the third day. He came in with an Excel spreadsheet, and the Excel spreadsheet had every episode of the season and what happened to each character on every, right? And so it was really up to us to help connect the dots. And he was like, there's a thing over here that happens. I don't really know what that is. You guys will help me figure that out. You know, we did a lot of research. He wanted us to bring in research. We were reading books. We had guest speakers. We brought in guest speakers. We watched documentaries. We made notes, all of these different things. It's a fascinating process. And not dissimilar from Stargirl, I think, you know, Jeff Johns came in to both the seasons that I was on the show, and he knew exactly where he wanted to go. And again, it was about how do we fill in the gaps? How do we shade in the characters? And, you know, so those things can be really fun. It doesn't, there are other shows where the map is a little less clear and the question becomes, what are we going to do this season? Or what's the next episode about? Or that sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be interesting and fun too. It depends on, and again, it depends. I think on some level, God Friended Me was a little bit like that. We knew we had sort of an arc. But then it was like, well, who's the person of the week who Miles is going to help and what's their story? And, you know, and so we spent a fair amount of time coming up with those things and pitching them in the room and writing up documents and then seeing which idea the showrunners were interested in pursuing next. And that's, you know, that's fundamentally different from coming in and knowing exactly what the scaffolding of the show will be and then sort of filling in some gaps.
Very stellar. And so this is even more intriguing because, you know, you hear all kinds of different writers' room, and obviously they're all grounded differently, but it is intriguing when sometimes you hear how some of them would get into punching matches. And it's like, geez, this is heated.
Yeah, there's dysfunction out there, and, you know, hopefully less and less of it, because I think it's, you know, it's a hard enough job. I mean, obviously, you know, even from the Twitter sphere, like people can see, you know, the way the pendulum swings in terms of how people are, you know, joyful about the way a show goes or disappointed or whatever. Like there are so many moving parts in every show. And so it's a hard job no matter what to, you know, to do 10 or 12 or 13 really good episodes is hard. You know, then when you're on a network schedule and you're doing 22 episodes every season. It's a lot to figure that out and to, you know, so it's a really hard job even without people punching each other in the writer's room or crazy anarchy stories. So hopefully, again, a lot less of that and a lot more grounded creativity.
1,000%. Let's hope. And altogether, I, you know, there's different ways that people want to write anything from an essay to public speaking. Event memo. I guess what would you often do to just kind of clear your head? Just like, I'm in the zone now, you know, nothing can disrupt my process.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. That's a really good question. There are a couple of things. One of them is about, you know, that downtime space. It's like, what's the, you know, for you who are listening, like, is it meditation? Is it, you know, for me, it's meditation, you know, getting on the exercise bike, sometimes like watching TV or going for a walk, like any of those things can help kind of clear the space, clear the hard drive. you know, and then you come back and you, you know, I always like to consider sort of diving into things I'm obsessed with, you know, so what's coming up in my dreams? Like what have I been, you know, scared of since I was 5 years old or obsessed with since I was seven, or, you know, the thing that really annoys me about traffic, to get back to that subject, like any, whatever it is, how can I then sort of take that thing that I'm fundamentally interested in and sort of, you know, expand it into some story space that continues to be interesting to me? Because again, if you're, you know, if you're writing, you know, a novel, or you're writing a script, or you're writing a film, and you're spending days, weeks, months, years on this particular project, like you better be interested in it. Otherwise you're going to run out of gas pretty soon.
Thousand.
Yeah.
Oh man. And have you also thought of doing a little more direction?
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about, for me, directing is a little bit utilitarian. I feel like it's one of those things that just, you need a director, you know. I don't know, in my experiences of directing, you're so busy. One of the things that anyone that I have noticed, that people out there, if they've done it, will notice, you know, as an actor, you work really hard to do, like I'm really working really hard in the five scenes that I'm in of this 10 scene thing. And then, you know, in the scenes I'm not in, I get to sort of rest. Well, the director never gets to rest.
No.
The director is there all the time, working through every scene, every moment, working with the props department, working with the costume people, working with the casting people, working with the music. You know, it's just like, it's constant. And I feel like there's some version of that that can be fun, but it's also pretty exhausting. So it's not, it's something that I've enjoyed and that I probably certainly will do again. And it's a lot. It's so much that my feeling is, you know, as I've done it, like it goes by in a blur and I'm like, what just happened? You know? So, I think some of those other things that I've done have felt a little more enjoyable because there's a little more space around them, but directing is full on.
Gotcha. maybe you could be the second unit director where you're just doing the pickups. You already know the story that you wrote.
I don't know, maybe.
Do you think streaming is, you know, going to probably be looking for extra content, or are they kind of at a standstill where they don't want to have too much?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like on some level, questions like that, which are really interesting, feel like they're more sort of outside the industry than inside the industry. My hope is that streaming will continue to be an expansive way for writers to make a living, but I don't know that I have any predictions about like what's really going to happen in that space. You know, what I do know is that and we've been talking about this a little bit, and we'll see sort of what the year brings, what 2023 brings for union stuff. But, you know, the streaming space is a fascinating paradox, because A, it means there's a lot of material that's being made, which is great, but B, it's shorter orders, right? So we have streaming shows that have 7 episodes, 8 episodes, 6 episodes.
It's so and quick.
It's become harder for the middle class writer to make a living, because he or she has to have more gigs per year in order to put together what a writer perhaps used to do if he was on a 22 episode, network show that perhaps he or she was on for years and years and years. Like that's a different kind of financial experience altogether. So I don't know. I wish I knew what was going to happen in the streaming world. I don't exactly know. So we'll all sort of experience that together.
No, totally. And I got to ask you this. How did you get involved with Sesame Street there briefly? I know it's pretty common for many New York.
Oh, yeah. Well, so I worked at Sesame Workshop, which is, you know, that's the company that produces Sesame Street. It used to be called Children's Television Workshop. And that's an interesting story, because it sort of goes back to, you know, we were talking a little bit about networking earlier. I basically had a moment where I was living in New York, and I had hosted a kid's show years before in the Baltimore area, And I was interested in getting back into both television and kids programming. And I wasn't really sure what to do. So I started reaching out to people I knew. And I reached out to the guy who had been my former co-host on the kids show that I was on.
Sweet.
And I basically picked his brain about people he knew. And he knew this woman who was working at Sesame Workshop as a producer of audio content, because he had started to do some radio stuff. And I went in and met with her basically for an informational interview, which is basically like sitting down with somebody and just saying, how did you get here? And what's your life like? And we had this lovely conversation, and she was super cool and really interesting. And, you know, we really hit it off. And I gave her a resume. She said to me, like, I'm not hiring. And I was like, no, I just wanted you to sort of see who I am. And
just consider me, please.
And then maybe it was 6 months later, she reached out and said, I'm actually hiring somebody to help me in the audio department here. And would you be interested, you know, in being an associate producer? And, you know, and there were several candidates, and I went through this whole process and, you know, ended up being fortunate enough to get hired. So,
That's great.
Yeah. And I worked on a bunch of interesting things. I worked on a radio show that never got on the air called The Real Deal. Actually, it aired a couple of times on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were doing in conjunction with them from New York, but it was sort of like a children's version of Fresh Air, sort of Fresh Air / All Things Considered. Like it sort of had that
NPR kind of feel.
Yeah, kind of an NPR sort of feel. So we worked on that, and that got, you know, we made two episodes and aired those. That the show didn't get picked up. But I also got to work on the South Africa co-production with the world's first HIV positive Muppet, which was really wild. And some of the some of the Muppet videos. I also did some stuff on video with Zoe's dance moves, and you know, so those were really interesting experiences to sort of see how production happens with, I think the primary difference there is like there's an education department, and those people are saying, well, here, you know, the curriculum in this needs to be X or Y, and you know, you're building things around an educational message, and that's a very specialized way to create stuff.
The skit really goes here, the moral of the story is in the last 10 minutes here, insert clips 1 through 10, you know.
yes right, like that.
And this goes for my B movie fans, they're big fans of Undefeatable.
Oh really, wow.
It's kind of gone around, it's kind of become kind of one of those beloved,
that's fascinating. I don't know that I've ever talked with anybody about
you'd be surprised. Cynthia Rothrock's kind of, even though like many of these B movie actors who mostly were made for TV, direct to video, they've kind of become bigger for streaming. Man,
yes, right. I'm sure
it's become a drinking game kind of movie, and I get it. Wow. You know, there's free riders attached. You know, it's a shared voice.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, just, you know, the brief story about that, because it was just so interesting and so unlikely. So I had hosted this kid show. I was living in Maryland, in Baltimore. And I had, before I hosted the kid show, I worked for the Maryland Film Commission. And one of the people who ran the Maryland Film Commission helped bring, and this was like so long ago, but they helped Warner Brothers bring a TV writing curriculum into, you know, some of the historically Black universities to sort of test it out. They were looking to sort of get more writers of color sort of into the industry. Anyway, so Morgan State University, which is in Baltimore, was one of the places where they did this pilot program for Warner Brothers. And this guy from the Film Commission told me about it. And I applied and I got in, and I did these two semesters there learning to write TV.
Nice.
In my second semester of this course, these basically Hong Kong filmmakers and investors came to the woman who ran the program and asked her to help them find writers to a writing team to create what became Undefeatable. And she randomly matched us up with, you know, with another classmate. And I got put with this guy who I didn't know, but who also went to Yale, a guy named Robert Vassar, who I, you know, I'm not really connected to anymore, although I see him on LinkedIn.
And, is he really?
yeah. And he was like a martial arts movie expert. Like he was also in the program, but he loved martial arts movies. And I think on some level I was like more of a writer and he was more of a martial arts person. And, you know, together we wrote and she put us together as a team and we pitched to these folks. Flying Dragon Imports was the company, and they hired us out of all the teams that they met, and we wrote this movie. The original title of Undefeatable was A Fatal Desire, and then when they made erotic. It, they changed it to Undefeatable. Yeah, and we also, once we wrote it, we just got paid, and we had nothing to do with like. I wasn't
set. That's how it typically went.
And I think actually there are a lot of things in that movie that we didn't write. I was like, I don't think we ever did that. But anyway,
it's annoying because then you're having to tell people, where can I find your earlier work? And you're like, yeah. No, it's not my voice at all.
It's an interesting part of my career that nobody ever talks about. So there you go. Thanks for bringing that up, Cam.
It's kind of become a drinking game kind of movie, just so you know. Because there's a
good to know
infamous moment where someone gets their tongue impaled on like a.
Oh boy.
Yeah, on a
On a it's spike. A long way from God Friended Me and Stargirl. I'd
say. Correct.
yeah,
but. No, you keep going back to radio. Have you thought of maybe also just coordinating with a lot of pals in radio and just because it seems like so many people, they hear Froof stuff because people still have the radio. They can still
I think radio is a fascinating medium. Like I'm obsessed with NPR. I'm obsessed with podcasts. You know, as I said, started a podcast recently, which is called The Secret Writer Podcast, and people should find it and listen. And it's on Apple Podcasts and other places. And I'm fascinated with, again, for me, the Holy Grail, and I think I've decided that or realized this year, the Holy Grail is making stuff. So whatever I can make, you know, and if I can make it easily and simply and find a way to sort of put heart and, you know, humanity in the middle of it, like that's really what I want to do. So any and all ways I'm interested in creating new things.
It's nice. Okay, well, anything else in the can that you want to kind of tease that's in the works or can't say?
Wow, what an interesting question. I'll give another shout out to my collection of plays, A Few Short Plays to Save the World, which is not only out there on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookshop.org, but it's also in some bookstores out there in the world. And it's been honored by a couple of the Hollywood Book Festival. And so I'm really proud of it. And it's a cool collection. And some of those plays, one of those plays is being done in 2023 at Vivid Stage in New Jersey. And another new play of mine that's not in the collection is being done in something called the Fire This Time Festival in New York. So, yeah, so all of that stuff is happening and I'm really proud of it. And who knows what else may percolate and show up down the line.
Nice.
Yeah.
For local New Yorkers, are there any plays we should check out that are upcoming? Obviously, we should always support the community, but it's...
Yes. So, yeah, I would say look up, go to the Fire This Time's website, and the evening of short plays that a piece of mine will be in, is coming up in mid-January. And we'll run for a couple of weeks at the Crane Theater. So, really excited about that.
For those who want to check out this man's invaluable work, Tell Me Your Secrets is still on Prime. God Friended Me can be bought on Amazon. Stargirl is on CW and HBO Max. And yes. American Crime is actually still on Hulu. So, and yeah, Covert Affairs is on Freevee.
Yes. Thanks for all those shout outs. And so great to be here. What a great conversation.
Absolutely. making it in this business, you know, it's not easy. Everyone likes. Before we go, why do people think that because there's you got all the fame and you're doing what you love creatively, that you're a superhero all of a sudden?
It's a good question. I think, you know, I think on some level, it's partly what we've created culturally. You know, like from the dawn of Hollywood, we've sort of, you know, whoever's been promoting stuff has been like, these people are next to God.
All this glitter.
Glitter and glamour and stuff like that. When the truth is, you know, everybody puts their shoes on one, you know, or their pants on one leg at a time. And we're all like, everybody is, you know, human and is going to eventually die and has whatever problems or issues or skin conditions. Like, we're all people.
Yeah.
Just trying to make our way. And I think it's, and I think it's really useful for interviews like this and, you know, whatever, reading books, biographies, like just recognizing that it's all a bunch of flawed human beings who are just trying to do their best and make, create things that, that other people might like. And we all, we're all human. So.
Because you are living your, a life that you love. And at the same time, it's not easy. So
that's right. Yes.
It's your 9 to 5, just like anyone else That's who works right. at an auto shop or.
and you know, the way the industry sort of pendulums and, you know, Stargirl, you know, has gone off the air now. And it's kind of like, well, what's the next job? You know, that's, it's not like you get a factory job and you're there, you can be there for 10 years or 15 years, which is also, you know, which is also happening all across the country in all kinds of professions where many, many workplaces are short lived. And so, you know, so it's a, on some level, it's amazing. And on another level, it's, you got to keep looking for the next gig or making the next gig and, you know, trusting the universe to bring the abundance and being willing to be kind to yourself on the in-between times.
Absolutely. The end's not near to us just yet, but
yes, right. Yes. We hope, we hope.
Wait, let's brace for impact though. Well, this is very inspiring and it was just very, just a very organized reflection that you brought across. And I hope everyone keeps hearing your cool narrative, the next one that you got to share.
Yeah. So great to be here. And I really appreciate all the deep questions.
And best of luck on your podcast. You know,
thank you.
I hope it's a fun side thing to do, you know, because.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's really, really fun medium.
Perfect. Well, everyone, yeah, you've heard his voice. Yeah. You've seen his work. Keep supporting the man, please.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsy, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.